saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fook's. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein.
Warren Zevon, the cult rock star and songwriter, was asked for some advice after he was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer in 2002. "Enjoy every sandwich," he replied. But in reality, Zevon enjoyed a lot more than sandwiches. His story is full of excess and extreme, both in his artistic creation and in his life. Crystal Zevon tells his tale in her new book, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hello.
Hi.
Did Warren ask you to write this book?
He did.
How long had you been divorced at the time?
We've been divorced. We were divorced in 81, so, you know, 20-some years.
So you'd maintained some kind of a relationship?
Yes. I mean, we had a daughter together, so we would maintain that kind of relationship anyway, but no, we remained close friends and confidants,
and neither of you remarried.
No.
Was he concerned about his legacy, especially when he realized that he didn't have all that much time to live?
He was concerned about his legacy, and he, you know, before he was diagnosed, he really had no career. His career had hit bottom. He was appearing in some folk festivals, but that was about the most he could do. He didn't have a recording. He did have, Danny Goldberg had a recording contract. That's not true. But the records weren't selling. He couldn't go out with a band.
Is before Letterman?
This is before Letterman. Mm-hmm. Well, before that last Letterman show.
Mm-hmm. But he'd been on the Letterman show a number of times,
yeah.
And he used to fill in for Paul Schaefer sometimes.
I mean, Letterman, he said David Letterman's the best friend my music ever had. And I think Letterman consistently had him on, and especially because he could do that. He was classically trained. He could orchestrate. He could work with the orchestra. And he could do the shtick with Letterman, which is, you know, requires a certain savoir-faire that most musicians don't have.
And then he decided, knowing he was going to die, to make one last album.
When he was first diagnosed, he spent the first couple of weeks looking for, you know, what does a man do when they're given a death sentence? What's the spiritual solution? How do I come to terms with a life? And, you know, he thought about a lot of things, going to India and having his ashes scattered in the Ganges, converting to Catholicism so he could confess his sins. But of course he woke up one day and said, well, I make music. That's my spiritual connection to this life.
And he can make really personal statements because he had nothing to lose.
Exactly.
You chose to write his story as a collective oral history,
mm-hmm.
because you realized you just didn't know enough by yourself that he was different, and that he was different people to different people.
Well, I think that he was different to different people. Yes. I realized somewhere through the process that I actually knew him very well. I think because we were young and in love and open and vulnerable when we started out, I was someone who did know all these sides of a very complex guy. I think that's a large part of why he chose me to do this work.
But you also got his diary, and I'm sure there were things there that surprised you.
There were things that surprised me. I mean, I certainly didn't know the extent of the excess with women or his compulsive disorders. I didn't know how tormented he really was.
He asked you to tell everything. Did you suppress some of the things?
I did.
Because
what I tried to do was give enough that, you know, the flavor was there. I mean, there are plenty of salacious details. I thought that's enough. You know, I wasn't trying to write a tabloid book or a tell-all, really. I wanted to show all sides of this man.
Well, you said he was obsessive. He suffered from what now people would call obsessive compulsive disorder, but probably was unaware of it. Do you think that most of the trouble he had was an attempt to self-medicate, to get himself through?
I do. I think, you know, in the days when he was drinking, I mean, he was a, you know, dyed-in-wool alcoholic. He was a garden variety drunk, really, of the worst kind, you know, where he lived in a blackout a lot of the time, and became violent and so on. I mean, underneath, I know that wasn't his character or what was in his heart, because he would feel terrible. He suffered greatly from the guilt of that. And a lot of the songs would come out of, you know, guilt or confusion or whatever that happened as a result of that. And when he stopped drinking in 1986, I think the compulsions and obsessions took over. And even though eventually there were medications for those things, he wouldn't take them because he was afraid that would ruin his sobriety.
He had a compulsive approach to,
yes, exactly,
to being off the wagon as much as being off the wagon.
Yeah, he did. Also, his creativity. You know, he didn't know what fueled that. He read the biographies of Van Gogh or Picasso or Beethoven, or, you know, so maybe he had to be mad in order to do what he did.
He was classically trained, although he didn't go to college. He obviously was an intellectual. Did
right.
that make him feel odd in that music world?
In a way, yes. Warren's closest friends, with the exception of Jorge Calderon, I mean, he had a lot of friends who were musicians and great musicians, and they looked up to him, even though most of them were much more successful commercially than he was. But his best friends were writers. He loved writers. So while his music has that classical bent, his lyrics are very literary. So writers loved him as well.
He was successful at the start, although he used a lot of different names.
Yeah. You know, the name Warren was named after an uncle of his mother's brother, who was killed in the Korean War. And to him, that was just ominous. There was a portrait of Uncle Warren when he grew up at his grandmother's house, and he always felt they held him up to that. And he had no desire to go to war or be that kind of hero. So
he assumed names like Lime. And he had he was part of Lime and Sibel. Mm-hmm. And they had a hit that people will remember, but I don't think associate with Warren Zevon, If You Gotta Go, Go Now.
Yep.
So what happened with that? Well, that's a rather commercial kind of a song.
Yes, and actually there's a CD that just came out, Preludes, of stuff that was never released. And on that are some tunes he wrote during that era where, you know, as Paul Schaefer observed, he could have written pop songs. He could have gotten huge commercial success writing those kind of songs, and he chose to go a different way.
But he did write for the Turtles, who mm-hmm. were a big pop group.
Mm-hmm.
They made a lot of money.
Right.
Was he making any money here?
Well, he was during that time, but he would make it and spend it. And then nobody really wanted to record Warren Zevon. And, you know, he wanted to do his own stuff. And that was difficult for a long time. His first album, Wanted Dead or Alive, was no success whatsoever, had no success. And
how much of that do you think was that the public didn't get it, and how much of it was that Warren just alienated so many people, and so he probably didn't get the kind of support he might have if he'd been loved by a lot of people?
Well, you know, he actually was loved by people. In spite of himself, he was loved by people. Bones Howe, who, you know, produced The Fifth Dimension, produced the Turtles, who produced The Association, was championed him for a long time, got him his record deals, and believed he had something, but he wasn't somebody Bones could produce.
And then Jackson Browne also had a relationship with him.
Yeah.
How important was Jackson Browne on his career?
If Jackson hadn't come along, I don't know that Warren would have had a career. And that's pretty important. He bookended his career. He got him his first record deal on Asylum with David Geffen, who didn't particularly like Warren or Warren's music. And so he had those Elektra Asylum days, and then at the end, when no one would give him a deal, Danny Goldberg put him on Artemis, his label, and at Jackson's behest. So,
you do get a feeling that the business changed over the years. In the early days, it was very casual. Everybody was a lot more helpful. They would drop in on your recording session. Today, you can't imagine any of that happening.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that was also a part of it. I'm sure like many others, assumed that it would always be the way it was when he started.
Right. Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, everybody stuck together. Everybody went and played their demos in each other's living rooms or dropped in on each other's sessions. And you know, if there was something going on that they could be on, they were on the record, as is evidenced by Warren's early records, for sure.
My guest is Crystal Zeevan, who has written a book called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zeevan. It's published by Echo. So how did you meet him? You were dating a guitar player he was working with?
I was dating Waddy Wachtel, and Warren was the band leader for the Everly Brothers, and he hired Waddy to go on tour.
He was playing piano for the Everly Brothers?
Yes.
And then he and Waddy wound up working together a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He stole you away from Waddy?
Like, kind of, yeah. you know, it was 1971 where, you know, monogamy was not the order of the day. Literally driving home from the airport, Warren was in the back seat and our eyes met in the rearview mirror and sparks flew and we moved in together about 3 weeks later.
But there are these weird things. He proposed to you with not a regular ring. You know, you would think that certain things might have been warning signs to you. And were you aware at all of his obsessive compulsive things?
You know, I knew that he had these odd habits, but nobody knew what that was in those days. I mean, the first thing that I really noticed was when we were driving, we were late to a meeting about a possible record deal. We passed on Sunset Boulevard under a billboard of Uncle Sam, you know, Uncle Sam wants you. And he couldn't, we had to turn the car around, go the other direction and move in this circuitous route to undo the bad spell.
Let's talk about Werewolves of London for a moment. This is not the kind of deep thing that the great poetry that people would associate with Warren Zeevan, and yet it was a big hit. He didn't take it seriously. In fact, weren't Warren and Waddy almost insulted when the record label chose it for the single?
Yes. Never in a million years did it occur to them that would be the single.
So what happened when they found themselves with a huge hit?
Warren, it was a mixed blessing and curse, that song for Warren, because he has songs that he worked on for years that are, you know, brilliant songs that nobody will ever attribute to him. Well, maybe, who knows? But he also said, you know, Werewolves of London allowed him to not pump gas for a living.
Mm.
So he could do what he loved to do.
Now, he's a guy, some people have said, only Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas was comparable as an alcoholic to Warren. And yet Warren collected guns. There's a kind of scary picture of Warren holding a gun to a stuffed Babar's head in the book. I'm not sure I'd want him reading bedtime stories to our kid.
Well, I mean, ultimately, that's where the relationship broke down. He didn't have guns when we first got together. He started collecting them actually when Ariel was born, when our daughter was born, saying we need protection. That's how he justified it to me. My father is a World War II vet. He'd always had a gun, so I thought, well, okay, I don't believe in this, but I'll let that one go. But, you know, eventually it got very scary.
He cleaned up for a while, as you said, but then he slipped again. Didn't his illness make him hot commercially, finally? How did he feel about that? I had to get sick. People had to know that I was going to die before they started taking me seriously again.
You know, humor is something that never left Warren. Up to the last day of his life, I think he saw the humor in things. He romanced death in a way. He was fascinated by it. He studied it. So when he was diagnosed, I talked to him that day, and he wasn't surprised. It was kind of, and then he decided, he told his manager, let's use this.
In fact, he told your son, Jordan, he said, I'm going to die, but I'm not going to do it John Prine style with a record that sells 10,000 copies.
Right.
So he knew he was recording something that was going to have hits.
Yeah, and Jordan is my stepson, just.
Mm-hmm.
He always believed, actually, that his notoriety would come after he died. Maybe that was how he consoled himself, you know, with a belief that, oh, they'll get it after I'm dead. But I have to say that more and more people seem to be, I'm getting letters now from people who had never heard of Warren, who read a review and are now listening to his music. I mean, read the book and are coming through the back door, I guess.
I guess we shouldn't be surprised that after he knew he was going to die, he went back to drinking.
I was surprised. I mean, he had been sober for 17 years. He called me up and said, the doctors say they'll give me all them Elvis drugs, is how he put it. And I'm not in pain, but they say I should go, I can have them anyway. And, you know, those of us who knew him from those days really didn't want to see that happen. But people who didn't know him from those days wanted to have a drink with the excitable boy.
Still, in the last year of his life, he had great creative success. He saw his grandsons being born.
Mm-hmm.
He reconciled with his family.
Yeah.
So he obviously wanted to complete things.
Yeah, and I think he did. I think he had a moment of fear, where the fear of death gripped him, and that's where he picked up a drink.
And once he picked up one drink, he could not stop.
Yeah.
What about you? Do you feel like it's been completed now that you've written this book?
I do. You know, it's funny because there were places I really didn't want to go back to. When I realized I'd promised him I'd do this, there were many times in the process that I thought, I can't do this. I can't expose myself, my children. But in the end, yes, it was cathartic. I think the residual resentments or whatever are gone.
Crystal Zevon's book, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon, is published by Echo. And let's go out with My Rides Here, Warren Zevon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Staying in the Marriott with Jesus and John Wayne. I was waiting for a chariot. They were waiting for a train, and the sky was full of carrion. I'll take the mazuma, sent Jesus to Marion. That's the pretend to you. My ride's here.
You can understand why Bruce Springsteen wrote a blurb for the book.